Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
You recently acquired a wine which really surprised me, you know, Ovid. The first thought that popped into my head was, you strike me as a very thoughtful person. Ovid has always been a very cerebral brand in my mind. So that's the only sense I could make of it in my head instantly, is just a reaction.
I don't know if you want the truth. I think that sounds more more exciting way to think about it. So the truth is that our very dear friends, Mark and Dana Nelson Johnson.
So yes, the founders.
The founders of Ovid. Mm-hmm. Were Montessori parents at the same time that we were. Our kids all went to the Montessori school in St. Helena. Mm-hmm. And so, and their twins are roughly the same age as our kids. And so the first time I went to Ovid was 2005.
Okay.
I've been personally buying the wines since the beginning. I have a full vertical of Ovid, and
excellent.
Was because I was really good friends with Mark, and the wines and the site is incredible. And you know, I'll never forget the first time I walked out on the porch in Ovid, and if anybody ever visits there, you happen to look directly down onto Silver Oak, so it's kind of this, you know, there's this sort of connection.
I get it now. Okay.
So, and then Mark and I were members of the St. Helena Montessori Dads Club, which mm-hmm. started out as a, which started when we were there, and Peter White was kind of the founder, I would call him sort of the godfather of it, and started out with like 10 or 12 guys, and we'd get together once a month and have coffee and donuts, as a matter of fact, and talk about how hard it is to be a dad of little kids. And it ended up that, only a few of us really hung in there. And so Mark and I were two of the stalwarts of the Dad's Club out of like four or five guys that would show up regularly. Daniel Villasenora was always there. Peter was always there. Daniel owns the Via Corona Mexican restaurant in downtown St. Helena.
Such a cool spot.
So we all became really dear friends.
Yeah.
And so when Mark and Dana made the decision that they wanted to move on, I guess would be the way I would put it, they called me and my friend Jack Bittner, and you'll read about this, it's been written in the press and stuff. We literally went up to their house, which is the adjacent property to Ovid, and sat down at their breakfast table and talked for 3 hours and shook hands and, made a decision that we were going to be the next stewards of the brand. And so, that's how that came together. So that it was something that I was already very passionate about and in love with as a consumer, and then saw as a business opportunity that, there's potential to grow it some. There's only 15 acres, so it's not, but it probably wasn't totally at its full potential. And I think Mark and Dana knew that. The whole team has stayed.
Austin.
They had a partner who was general manager, and she was part of the buyout. So Jack Bittner then became general manager, but Austin's still there, and the rest of the team, Caitlin and Jessica and everybody, and so Juanita, and so it's a it's been a fun thing. We've tried to keep Ovid what it is, and yet also make it better at the same time. I think a little bit like Silver Oak, that mm-hmm. And so we're it is, and I think the wines that we're producing are incredible, and we're still getting a lot of accolades in the press and all that kind of thing, which again we don't really do for Silver Oak, but Ovid is a little bit of a different animal that way. So I think that's really about opportunity. It's not something that I, we're not trying to, some of my fellow vintners are out acquiring, different wineries and consolidating and going corporate and doing all that kind of thing. And that's not what Ovid is about at all. It's about, a couple of my really close friends started something that's an absolute gem in the Napa Valley, and they wanted to move on. And, you know, not too different than Justin when Justin made the decision to sell Silver Oak. We're like, so when Mark and Dana approached me about buying Ovid, you know, to me, I was like, well, I've done this before. I know what this looks like. And so I think it was, and, you know, like it was a similar thing too, that there's a lot of pride and love, and the land is involved. And so because I've also acquired a number of vineyard properties, some of which were in families, you know, for 50, 60, 70 years, there's a lot of emotion around that too. It's not, you know, it's not just a business transaction about trying to get the highest price. I think one of the properties that we acquired in Oregon, for Toomey, which is an incredibly special place, and I cannot wait to get wines in people's glasses, which is going to happen this fall, from our 2017 Prince Hill. Prince Hill is a vineyard that was Dick Erath's home.
Oh, wow.
So if you're an Oregon Pinot Noir fan, you know, you're probably familiar with the brand Erath. Dick started the brand.
Wow, again?
Sold the brand in 2009
and
retired. And then in 2017, he was looking for, he wanted to sell his home property, which is right outside of Dundee. It's a beautiful top of a hill, you know, in the Red Hills of Dundee. And it was very important to him, like, who that next steward was. So Tim and I went up and sat down at Dick's breakfast table for 3 hours and had a similar conversation, you know. And so we were able to then buy the property from Dick and his wife, and they've become friends, and Dick's still around, and he's, you know, he's doing great. And so so again, you know, when Mark and Deanna presented the opportunity, it was something that I think you have to be keyed in and know that, you know, that this is a difficult thing for people to you know, to make that change. And so and as a matter of fact, Mark and Deanna are still partners in Ovid.
Really?
They kept a small interest, and so they're wonderful partners, and you know, that was part of the way that we were able to put the thing together and make it happen. And so that, I don't think that's a secret. So, and we're proud to have them, you know, still part of it. So, although we don't see them enough, I can tell you that they're busy doing the next thing now. So,
what level of trust must they have had, you know, Mark and Dana, and also Dick Erath in you, to let you take care of their baby?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, some of it comes from we've just demonstrated that over time, right? And I say
you
we, not talking about myself in the third person, the family,
yeah,
you know, and the whole bunch here at the winery. I mean, I do feel like we approach the business, the wine business, from, you know, it is a business, and so it can be a passion play too, but it, you know, you have to have an economic engine, and there are definitely vintners here whose economic engine is not their winery, it's something else. They made a lot of money doing something else. For us, this is our economic engine. This is, you know, this is our main business. This is what we do. And so you know, I think we have a lot of faith in ourselves, and I think hopefully then others can see that and build that trust to,
yeah,
you know, to allow us to be the next stewards.
You have proof of concept galore.
Yeah, we hope so. Knocking on wood.
So you have vineyards in the Alexander Valley and Napa and Oregon. Anywhere else, or?
Not yet.
Not yet, but.
Yeah.
Future planning. I have a feeling that, you know, you're already planning quite a bit ahead. In fact, one of the conversations you mentioned, 50-year plan, 5-year plan, 100-year, there's like a structure moving forward that's very strategic.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think for Silver Oak, having the two new wineries and all the new vineyards that we have coming into production here in the next couple of years is going to, you know, Silver Oak's kind of on a glide plane that looks really good, you know, and I think we know we have the demand. I think the wines are going to get better. And hopefully that is encouraging to our listeners that they're already pretty good. And so, but that is something we are just steadfastly committed to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with the fruit that we have, I'm just really excited about the continued improvement in wine quality. For Toomey, I think, you know, there's having the Oregon Pinot and releasing his first single vineyard Pinot is a very exciting moment for us that'll happen this fall with the 17 vintage. The wine's is amazing. And, you know, we make single vineyard wines from Bienvenido, from Gary's Vineyard in Santa Rita, as well as Soberanos. You know, we're looking forward to growing our relationship there because, you know, it's
just some of the best vineyards in the
Central Coast and maybe in California.
Yeah.
So there's, all, you know, I think there's continues to be opportunity for Toomey. You know, it's very interesting. I've had consumer interactions where this actually happened to me. I had somebody come up to me at a tasting one time and said, oh, I'll have the Toomey. And then they looked at the other bottle and they go, what's Silver Oak? I've never heard of that.
Oh my god!
so they knew Toomey, but they didn't know Silver Oak, which was you know, very gratifying. So
I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
So back to Ovid for just a second. I know sometimes there's trepidation when the brand is acquired, and it is so wonderful to hear you say nothing has changed. The basic foundations. What you're doing is that you're investing in it to make it better.
Right.
And you know, as a consumer myself, I mean, we're all emotional creatures. It's like, oh, there's a change. Change is always scary, right? But what you're doing for the brand is going to make it that much more exponentially better, is what you just really described, because now there's resources and intent to keep improving everything.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there's wonderful, there's always been wonderful intent at Ovid, but I think, you know, backing that up with sort of the foundation of what the Duncan family has and brings to the table, and again, not to take anything at all away from Mark and Dana and what they created, but you know, hopefully that'll be the case. I mean, you know, there is change in systems and stuff like that that we have to do, but the vineyards didn't change, and that's what Ovid's really about, is that site and that very special place and trend in Austin's, you know, exquisite ability to express what the place is in the bottle. And you know, which is very different from what we do at Silver Oak, for instance. Not that different from what we think about with Toomey, but you know, Ovid is you know, again, philosophically fit into what we do very, very, very well, and something that I personally understood really well because I had been, you know, a fan from the beginning.
That is so cool.
So
I'm sorry, but it just cool. They make such soulful, intellectual wines. You make wines of a different style. They're just different.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're able to recognize, not just recognize, but really attach emotionally to what they're doing, because I can see it in your eyes as you're talking about it. This is very, very special to you.
It's very special. Yeah. I'm very proud of it.
You mentioned something about not chasing scores, and it caught my attention because, let's be honest for a moment, a lot of the brands, whether they admit it or not, you know, very driven by accolades, by the press, by, you know, the appraisal of what they do. And you have categorically stated that is not what we do here. So tell me more about that.
Well, I think, you know, the, so I have a bottle, I have a, my own anecdotal story. The 2002 Toomey Merlot was released, and Robert Parker gave it 94 points and called it a sex pot of a Merlot. I'm not sure you can use that term anymore, but that's what he called it in about 04 or 05. And 6 months later, Jim Lobby, who's the prominent taster at Wine Spectator, came out and rated the wine 79 points, and you know, which is insulting, right? And
bad
so maybe he had a bad bottle, whatever. But I was like, well, if Parker's tasting it as a 94 and Lobby's tasting it as a 79, you know, what does that mean? And that my epiphany for that was that it's one person tasting a bottle of wine, and one guy liked it and one guy didn't, you know, and we can't make wine for everybody. And so, you know, I think that was kind of a real seminal moment for me, where I was like, I don't want to make wine for one person to say they like. I want to make wine for a lot of people to enjoy in their moments in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so we just sort of moved away from the whole score thing, and you'll find scores from time to time of our wines, you know, but but we don't, it doesn't matter, you know? And so, you know, and I do think, I do really relate winemaking to art. And, you know, like I have a personal, bias towards more like older style fine painting. Let's just say, let's just take painting as, you know, one thing, because I say I don't like art that I think I could do. And so, so when I see the canvas that's painted blue, you know, like the whole canvas is painted blue and it's hanging in the Museum of Modern Art somewhere in, you know, Paris or New York or Chicago or wherever, like, I don't get that, you know? And so to me, that's, you know, that's not something that's appealing to me. And so, you know, which if you took that to wine, it may be X, Y, or Z wine, you know, I think, and so I think to say, or, you know, I'm a music lover. So I think to say, well, the Rolling Stones is a 96 point band and the, and Mozart is a 93 point band or song, you know, whatever, is just completely nonsensical. And so I just don't think the scoring system is proper for wine, and, you know, especially the 100 point scoring system, and especially the, you know, given the fact that that score lives with that bottle of wine forever. And so it only gets, you know, generally it only gets tasted once and they assign a number to it and then it, it lives on. And that's just totally nonsensical because wine changes over time. Your experience with the same vintage of wine will change depending on where you are. So some days you might open a bottle of wine that it'll taste like a 92 and some days you'll open it and it might taste like 100 depending on where you are and who you're with and, you know, how great that moment is. And so, so that's why I do appreciate often the writing of wine critics. And I think that's important for consumers to understand. But I think the 100 point scoring system is just doesn't make any sense.
I've been expressing similar sentiments, and in my case it doesn't mean nearly as much as when you do that, which leads me to a personal request. Please say that early and often, because what you said is seminal. Assigning a number, assigning some sort of digits to a living thing, you know, it's inherently wrong. And I wish that we would find a way to divorce ourselves from that yardstick and really enjoy wine for what it is at the moment of time.
Yeah.
Words are important, descriptors are important, particularly yours and your winemakers. The rest of us, we all have palates. So let's listen to you and listen to ourselves, and maybe not so much to the third parties that are tasting it in a moment in time very fast. And I'm not saying that critics is not important. I'm saying you cannot use it unless you align perfectly with them, practically speaking.
Right.
Because if a critic like Glaub would rate your wine, you know, again, we don't even know if he had the right bottle. And then that would influence you. That would prevent you from so much pleasure. So it's so self-defeating.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can, you know, I have, you know, I think that's the scale, well, I have my own scoring system, which I might have to explain to you. But, you know, basically the scale should be based on, would you buy that bottle of wine again?
Okay.
So my, can I tell you
yes,
my scoring system?
Yes, no, I insist. Please do.
So one of my favorite wine descriptors, and I love it when I hear this at consumer tastings or at wine dinners or in the tasting room, is when somebody says yummy, right? Yummy is the highest. So my scoring system is based on the word yummy. So why is why bother? This wine is not good. I don't like it. I will never buy it again. Why you is you might like this bottle of wine, but I don't. So I don't like the rich, slightly sweet, over-the-top style of wines, whether they're Cabernet or Rhone varietals or whatever. Not into that, you know, high alcohol, over-the-top style. So that's a that's a YU.
Yeah.
YUM is a yum. It's a decent wine. It's the wine I'm, you know, having while I'm waiting for my flight at the airport or whatever. It's a, it'll satisfy for the moment, but not necessarily something I'm hot about.
Yeah.
YUMM is yum. And so that's a wine that I would buy again, that I enjoy, that I'm happy to share with my friends. And then yummy is the wine reserved for my cellar. That's something that I want to collect and own and be part of. And so that's my scoring system. And I stand by it. And it's definitely not a 5-point scoring system. So
No, but you just solved a lot of problems just like that.
Yeah.
I think that should be implemented widely. I like it.
It's like Linux. You can just put it out on the internet. It's fine. Everybody can take it. I don't need to own it.
Well, thank you. I was about to ask whether it's proprietary, trademark, or
No, it's David Duncan's scoring system for Yummy. So it's a.
I'm still putting it on my website and giving you credit, of course. But this needs to start catching on. You know,
I mean, it's a good. It's actually a good construct. And we do a lot of competitive blind tastings.
Yeah.
And I use the construct often because if I taste a wine that's a YU. You know, like, I'm like, why don't I like this wine? And how could I appreciate that somebody else might? And then it gives me that construct. Or, you know, if I taste a wine that's kind of middle of the pack, you know, then that's sort of a yum, like, it's fine. It's okay. But then if you taste something in a blind flight, which, of course, is for your listeners, is absolutely the best way to learn and taste wine.
Yes.
Not more than 8 glasses in a flight. And, you know, then you can really... You can really pick something out that's extraordinary and say, okay, well, I really like this. And then when they unveil, you can learn a lot about your own palate and what you like. And, you know, and honestly, sometimes I'll like the less expensive bottle of wine. That's great. It's easier on the wallet, you know?
Yes.
So, and that's where I think consumers, particularly people who are new coming into enjoying fine wine, need to understand that they should enjoy what they like. And they don't have to be told by somebody else, you know, oh, you're wrong. You know, just enjoy what you like. And if you like the big, rich, ripe, over-the-top cab, go for it, you know, because I'm not going to be competing to buy that bottle with you. So, you know, but that's fine. You can't take that away from their experience. And
yeah, give yourself permission to like what you like. It's that simple.
I mean, people do it with food all the time, right?
Like, yeah.
We're always on the next fad of no gluten or gluten or steak or fish or chicken or... You know, I don't eat red meat or, I mean, not me personally, but if somebody's saying that, you know, again, like art or music, or then we apply everything, it makes sense to people until you come to wine. And then we have this thing, well, oh no, we pigeonhole wine into, you know, 92 points. Like, it's absurd. It's absurd.
Agreed wholeheartedly. You said you taste wine, I assume, with your staff, with your... peers, you know, however it gets put together in terms of, you know, varietally or vintage-wise or different producers that are comparable. How often do you do that?
Ooh, a lot. We have good opportunity to do that. So we, you know, we always, we do these what we call competitive blind tastings. So we'll pick like our next release of wine. It's like we just did one with the 14 Napa.
Uh-huh.
So we'll get a flight of wines, or sometimes we'll do two flights, both of which will have the silver oak in, but then the rest of them will all be different wines. So just to get an idea of, you know, how we fit into the world of wine, you know, so for us, it's not so much hedonistic or finding out what we like, or even, it's not even about trying to pick out our bottle of wine necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do we fit into, what consumers are offered out there. And so, you know, and there's obviously hundreds and hundreds of wines that are available.
Yes.
And so, you know, we just do a few that are, you know, but the, you know, and the people that are in our competitive set are kind of, you know, easily recognized and pretty straightforward. So that's really mostly our purpose. I think for Pinot Noir for a long time, for instance, when we started making Pinot, you know, we were making, or Sauvignon Blanc is actually a better example. Let me use Sauvignon Blanc. So when we started making Sauvignon Blanc, we made 4 vintages without ever selling a bottle to the public, because we weren't satisfied with what we were putting in the bottle. The wine was good. It was a yum. And so, but it wasn't, so we sold those first 4 vintages, and I'm talking about a couple hundred cases of vintage, to the employees for $5 a bottle. So that's everybody who's going home.
Another reason to work for you.
So, so it was good. You know, it was a good deal for $5 bucks a bottle. But then as we hit on our style, we, you know, and became really proud of that wine, you know, but we went through this whole process of tasting a ton of Sauvignon Blanc because Sauvignon Blanc is a grape varietal that can be made in very, very, very different styles. If you have a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc or a Sancerre or a California Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah.
And so, like I know that I personally don't like grassy Sauvignon Blanc, mm-hmm. which is very typical in most of New Zealand Sauvignon Blancs and mm-hmm. Australian. So I don't like the grassy flavors. So ours is not grassy. It's stone fruit and mineral mm-hmm. and much more like Sancerre than it is, you know, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. So those are, which are decisions you can make based on your viticultural practices, your picking decision, mm-hmm. you know, somewhat of what you do in the winery to try and where your fruit comes from, all those different types of things. So mm-hmm. so that like that's a good example of how we might use competitive tasting to develop, you know, a new thing that we're doing, which in Sauvignon Blanc was something we started in 2003. Mm-hmm. So
have you been surprised during those trials, so to speak? Has anything ever stood out as, oh my God, this is like so good, or conversely, you know, so different? Or has there been any positive or negative takeaways of dramatic proportions from those things?
Well, the 14 Napa tasting that we just did, the group ranked, I actually ranked Silver Oak first or second, and I thought I knew what it was, and so, but then I was trying not to put it first because you don't want to do it because of house palate, but mm-hmm. But the group ranked Silver Oak in the lower half in that tasting, and what we determined is that the not to get too geeky, but the standard deviation of the tasting was super wide. So okay. everybody liked different things, and basically the 8 bottles of wine we had in front of us were all great wines. Mm-hmm. So if they're all really high standard, high quality, high ranking type of wines, you know, that's good company to be in. And it almost didn't matter who ranked what first or who ranked what last, because mm-hmm. everybody had a different opinion. So that's the epiphany, right? It's not that it's not that there's some wine. I mean, we have had the opportunity where a wine will do incredibly well and get a very, in the way we rank and score for the group think, we would get a very low score, which is a good thing because that means more people ranked it in the one or two. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, so occasionally we'll have a wine that'll really stick out that way. And we had some Oregon Pinots that did that, you know, led us to thinking about really going to Oregon and making Pinot Noir from, you know, a place. And then it took us 5 years to find a place to do it, you know. So, well, yeah, really 3 years, I guess, till we bought the vineyard. But, you know, so that, and I think like some of the Oregon Pinot Noirs are the wines that I'm most excited about in terms of the, you know, you talked about intentionality earlier with Ovid, but the level of quality and the rapid improvement and understanding of sight in Oregon mm-hmm. is something that's happening right now, and we can see that, you know, happening. And so I think, you know, there's some special wines, both Pinot and Chardonnay, that are going to come out of Oregon in the next 10 or 20 years. You know, I think it is the, you know, it's, I call it Napa in 1982. You know, if you think about where Napa was in 1982, there were just a handful of wines that anybody had ever heard of, and now mm-hmm. there's, you know, literally probably hundreds of excellent quality wines that come out of this area. I think Oregon's in the exact same place, that people are refining their practices and thinking about winemaking and thinking about site really intentionally, and the viticultural and the farming part. And so that, you know, it's a renaissance. It's not a rebirth. It's a birthing. It's a new thing.
Yeah.
That's really exciting. So
in Napa, we kind of went from grape growing to wine growing awfully fast.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, you know, I'd say it took 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's so exponential. I feel like you just pointed out, we're drinking so much better.
Right.
Every year there's that incremental improvement. Is that your opinion as well?
Oh, absolutely. Which is why I talk about, you know, like our fruit sourcing improvement, that, you know, basically we don't buy fruit from the valley floor.
Yeah.
Which is fine, but you're making yum wines from the valley floor, and you're making yummy wines from the hillsides.
Oh.
Or the opportunity to build it in wineries, you know, that's something that, well, I always say we made good juice in the old place, that just having, you know, the most modern and kind of idealized fermentation capacity is a luxury that, you know, it's without a fire, you just don't get, because people don't rebuild their wineries. You just, you know, you don't think, oh, well, it's been 20 years, time to rebuild the winery, you know, and so... Like here in Oakville, we built the fermentation room so that everything in the barn can be removed.
Oh, wow.
So we could, you know, without having a fire, redo the whole way we do things, you know, because we have this footprint. You know, and that being said, we put it together in the way we thought would work best for making our Napa. And it's worked pretty well for 10 years. And so, you know, we don't need to necessarily change everything. But it is, you know, those are the kinds of things that I think happen over time. And I think, you know, if you look at the old world for some guidance there, you know, the French did, especially in Bordeaux, well, and in Burgundy too. Well, but let's just say, let's just use Bordeaux. They did everything the same for 200 years, right? Mm-hmm. And then the world competitive market has changed that. So in my visit to Bordeaux, I saw a lot of stainless steel, a lot of modern winemaking equipment, a lot, all the same presses and everything that we use here, you know. And so I think that that's informed even the old world view of winemaking, and that, you know, you've got to stay relevant, and, you know, you've got to stay up with what's happening, because you can't, you know, you can't just keep doing things the same way forever.
I find it somewhat entertaining that, you know, people are so attached to the warm and fuzzy kind of romantic terms of everything natural, you know, no equipment. Most of the sophisticated machinery is designed in France.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And presumably used there as well. How, technologically speaking, do you have optical sorters? I mean, what do you utilize in the cellar?
So one of the things that we have a great opportunity to do is do a lot of experimentation. So we've done a lot of experimentation with optical sorters, and I'm not talking about small, you know, 20-gallon bucket experiments. I'm talking about 7-ton fermenters that are, we'll do one optical sorted and one not optical sorted. And so we have found that there's technology that makes a difference, and there's technology that doesn't make a difference.
Okay.
And so so we don't use an optical sorter to answer your question.
Really?
Because we found that we've had absolutely no benefit and quite a bit of loss, actually.
How about that?
So I know there are winemakers who are still adamant about it. I'm not the winemaker, thank God, and I'm also not one of them that says, you know, and so there's other, you know, there, and I think the most important thing that's happened in the wine industry in the last 15 years is the technology in the vineyard.
Okay.
And so that is something that has changed dramatically, and we've adopted a lot of technology in the vineyard. We work with Thibaut Scalage at Fruition Sciences, and so we're charting all the weather and our microclimates. We are, the advent of drones has been amazing, because we used to fly airplanes to get like infrared pictures of the vineyard to see where weak spots are. Now you can, and that, you know, that we would do that every 2 or 3 years, because you might spend $6,000, you know, on a flight to do, because it's expensive, right?
Yeah, of course.
And so now you can have a drone, and you can, you could literally do it daily, you know, and that'd be a little bit of overkill. But so our water management, our canopy management, we're in a process of a replant in Soda Canyon, where we're taking, you know, they're not literal, but just for the sake of the listener, north-south rows that were all planted to make it easy for a tractor to go through by the previous owner of Soda Canyon, and we're making them into viticultural sites that, from our experience in the vineyard and from the data that we've collected over the last 10 years, you know, we know that this low spot is a block by itself because it's a low spot, or that this hillside is going to grow, you know, the grapes in a consistent way, but the vineyard doesn't, it doesn't need to be square. You know, that's a human construct, not a, not a geologic or dirt construct. So, so those are the, and basically what we're trying to do is get this, the block, if you will, of the grapes to be ripe at the same time. So that's the goal, so that everything that goes into the tank is of the same ripeness. And so that's something that, like, we're literally applying out in the field right now in our replant. And it doesn't make for pretty blocks. They're not all square and neat and cornered, but it's going to produce, you know, better wine. So that's like when you talk about technology,
yeah,
that's where my mind goes more as to the you know, the vineyard than necessarily than what's happening in the winery.
That is absolutely,
you know, the expression that there's like 10 decisions you can make in the winery and 1,000 that you make in the vineyard, right? So the vineyard's where it all comes from. And so if you're manipulating a lot of things in the winery, you're not doing it right in the vineyard, you know? So.
Wow. I mean, there's so much emphasis in different fermentation vessels, for instance, you know, concrete and amphores and.
Yeah, but if you put lousy fruit into you know, a 5-gallon bucket, it doesn't matter, right? So your fermentation, I mean, I think a lot of winemakers probably would say that what comes in from the vineyard is a given. But that's not true, and that's and to me, the way we've affected, and really what we're trying to maximize is the flavor development at low sugar. So, and we can do that through deficit irrigation or no irrigation, and really drive the flavor development at the lowest sugar that we can get, so that we can make a balanced, beautiful wine from 23 and a half or 24 Brix grapes, instead of picking at 27 to get all this flavor and then watering it back or dealking it or, you know, whatever. We try not to do that as much as we can. I mean, and I say try not to because a lot of that depends on Mother Nature.
What a phenomenally informed approach. Everybody says wine is grown in a vineyard, but, you know, what is a vineyard? What does it really mean? What you're describing is, in fact, redesigning the vineyard architecture based upon scientific data and creating a vineyard that's optimized.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes, very much so.
Wow. Yeah.
And we're doing that in real time, and it only takes 5 years when he wants to make the replant decision. You know,
wow.
It's something that's so hard to understand that it just takes, everything takes a lot of time.
No, but it makes so much sense now why you're so successful. I mean, there's clearly an emotional aspect that, you know, stays in people's minds and hearts, and the way you treat your consumers, but you do so much work to put the best bottle of wine on their table. It's clear.
Yeah, we try, and we have an amazing team that all pulls together to, you know, make it happen.
I'm curious as to what your observations are about Napa Valley. You've now been here for, you know, decades, and I know that you've mentioned the wonderful parts, which is everybody, you know, consumers drink better, everybody's making better wines at, you know, as a community. Are there any concerns that you have for the Valley?
Well, certainly, you know, the Board of Supervisors acted last week. So, you know, I think the this little bit of a rift between the, you know, the I don't know how to phrase it right, you know, the sort of keep it the same kind of no growth attitude versus you know, the support the industry mm-hmm. kind of attitude. I mean, I was the chair of the Napa Valley Vendors a couple years ago mm-hmm. during the whole APAC time, which was the Agriculture Protection Committee. I am a staunch believer and supporter of the agricultural preserve, mm-hmm. but I also believe that I know many of the homeowners basically who are, there's not a lot of vintners who are on the side of, you know, do away with winery visitation.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think we need to, you know, live within our means, but we also need to be practical about, you know, what's happening here. So that's the biggest risk to the Valley right now. And, you know, I think that as a longtime land lover and owner, there's this concept with land around the highest and best use of okay. land. So I think the other thing is, does Cabernet Sauvignon in Napa Valley remain the highest and best use of the land, which is the predominant grape varietal here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, because if I could take out an acre of Cabernet and plant, you know, marijuana plants and make a ton more money, can I, you know, that would motivate some people. It's not going to motivate David Duncan, but it might motivate other people. You know, if I could build housing,
yeah.
you know, that's what happened in Santa Clara, right? Like the highest and best use of the land. They say that Santa Clara was an equally perfect microclimate like Napa is to grow great wine varietals. Well, they never really got the chance because starting in the 60s, it all got built up into tract homes. And, you know, so you think about that as, you know, as Napa Valley, if somebody fought that, you know, would they? So those are the threats, I think, that, you know, there is an economic reality. And I talked before about, you know, you've got to have something for your engine, you know, your economic engine. And so we need to keep producing wines here as a community that the world wants and will buy, you know, so that we can preserve what this place is. And so we need people to come and visit and purchase wines. And so there is a little bit of a conundrum, you know, in terms of, I don't like sitting in traffic any more than anybody else does. And so, but also, we also can't say, you know, there's no more, because that, you know, you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. So.
No, I hear you loud and clear. I mean, preserving this as an agricultural community. I know people again think of wine as a very romantic subject, but it is an agricultural community first and foremost.
Absolutely.
And you know, we're all responsible individually in preserving it if we all do our parts. And rather than complaining about, you know, prices or traffic, maybe we can think about, you know, take a helicopter view and think about what it really means to have this valley and how precious it is to everybody that's ever set foot in it. It's a magical spot and we need to protect it.
Yeah, for sure.
Last but not least, I've been looking at a very special instrument, your guitar, that's quite intensely autographed. And I know that music is a big part of your world and you have a band. So please tell us more about that.
I'll tell you about the guitar first. So this is a guitar that was actually in a flood in my basement in my home.
Wow.
And I took it in to have it repaired by a luthier, and he goes, "It's wood. It'll dry out. Don't worry about it." And so I thought that was funny. And so I brought it back to the and I had it at the winery. And we were visited by Lance Armstrong and Sheryl Crow. This was when Lance was on the top of his game.
Wow.
And he was dating Sheryl Crow. You know, some people might remember that time.
Yeah.
And so I asked them to sign it. So here's Lance's signature there, and here's Sheryl Crow's here.
She
said, "Keep on rocking." And so then it sort of started this thing for me that the rule with the guitar is that I have to hand it to whoever signs it. So we've had a lot of, you know, we have a lot of artists stop by that if I'm not here, they don't sign the guitar. But, you know, I've got Taj Mahal and Kelly Clarkson and Steve Winwood and Bob Weir, and I'm kind of agnostic when it comes to music. So Chuck Lavelle from the Rolling Stones, Dave Grohl is one of my favorites, Michael Franti, Thomas Rhett, Kelsey Ballerini, you know, on and on and on. So it's great fun. So, I don't know what I'll do with it someday. Auction it off or something, but
probably for charity.
It's a good thing. And then the band is fun. There's a bunch of vendors, Jeff Gargiulo and me and Shane and Tress and Joe and Paul, and Dan. And, we get together and we've played, one of our claim to fame is we've played Bottle Rock every year, so we're playing on Saturday.
Wow, very cool.
This year, and you know, we have a good time. So I think of the band more like poker night, that the rehearsals are actually what it's all about, and being with the guys, and then the performances are, you know, something we have to do.
Oh, you're quite good. They would not have tapped you to perform at Bottle Rock if you were just a band.
Yeah.
I think you're quite so, here's an incentive to come to Bottle Rock. Like, there wasn't one already, and like it wasn't sold out, but I would say, and I've heard your music, you're really good.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's fun.
My last question is more of a philosophical nature, and that is, if you could get the world to stop for a few moments and listen to you, what would you say?
I would say we need to be good stewards of the land. You know, I think that is, and I say that in like a global sense, that, you know, and I'm not a proponent of one way or the other on climate change and all that kind of thing, but I think, you know, I think respect for the land and respect for our Mother Earth is something that as the population continues to put more and more and more pressure, it is a tough, you know, is a tough thing to think about and live with. And so, you know, I'm a farmer and we do, so, you know, we're doing our part. So all of our vendors are certified sustainable. You know, I've got two LEED Platinum wineries. I'm working on the other ones that are not LEED certified yet. But, you know, if I think if everybody just did what they could, we, you know, the whole place would be better off. And so I think that would be something that, you know, there's a lot of other things I have opinions on, but that's what right now what strikes me today is sort of, you know, we have to think about ways to produce food or, you know, forestry as a sustainable activity or, you know, and not have the financial reward outweigh the damage that, you know, sort of irreversible damage we're doing to, you know, rainforests or or anything like that. I mean, it's just a, there's just a lot to that. So.
So the message of sustainability is not an abstract notion. It's personal.
Yeah.
And you're doing your part on both personally and on the scale. And, you know, everything you've described today is, you know, part of that bigger message. So I want to personally thank you for doing your part, for being so aware and helping us also develop that mindset that's so necessary, because if we all did just a little bit, we would all be better off.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for a wonderful conversation and all the insight.
Good, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson. We'll see you again next week.